From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, our connection for this hour was made in April of 2014 in the city of Flint, Michigan. City leaders there were excited about a plan for Flint to change who provided its water. This plan was going to require some changes, and officials had come up with a temporary replacement source for the water. Flint had been getting its water from its own nearby Great Lake, that remarkable freshwater source that has become the envy of so many struggling local governments in the West. But for now, Flint would get its water, including its drinking water, from the Flint River. And as journalist Anna Clark explains in her book, The Poisoned City, the Flint River might have been a logical choice for much of its history. But in recent decades, the river had become a home to dumping all kinds of unsavory, toxic, dangerous materials. But the government assured residents, this is fine. The water is safe. And on that April day, the local political leadership literally toasted to the change. They boasted about how wise the decision was. They observed that the water tasted like water. But within days, the water didn't taste like water. It tasted like metal. It looked like coffee. It made the eyes of children burn when they ran through it on a hot summer day. It caused irritation when people used it for showers and baths. And yet, for too long, officials insisted that, no, the water's fine. Well, how did this happen? Clark describes it as an urban tragedy. Her book chronicles the failures and the fight and offers a kind of warning for how this could happen in other cities, too, given the history in this country of how we've constructed communities and what we prioritize and what we don't. Anna Clark is in Rochester today, and this hour, we're honored to have her as our guest right here on Connections. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
And also with us is Molly McNulty, a lecturer in public health law at the University of Rochester. Molly, welcome to you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks very much.
There is an event this afternoon, 4:30 at the University of Rochester. What's coming up?
Yes, the Political Science Department is sponsoring their Cutler Lecture at 4:30, and Anna Clark will be speaking, and it's in Wegmans Hall on the River Campus at the U of R.
Now, as a lecturer in public health law, there's and there's been a number of books written about what's happened in Flint. This is just one of them. For me, this is sort of the chronicling in detail and journalistic effort that is probably going to be taught and referred to for many, many years.
Indeed.
And while there are so many important personal stories, there's the work of activists and community organizing, there's also the question of how this happened in the first place. So Molly, when you dug into this book, knowing some of the story I'm sure you knew already, what are the big public health law aspects of this that stood out to you?
Probably the biggest aspect is accountability and the role that the law plays and hinders in holding the decision makers accountable. There are two dimensions that make this a very complex issue. One is our federalist nature of government, where there are multiple decision makers, federal, state, local. And the other problem is the three branches of government. It's very civics 101, but you've got legislatures passing laws, agencies passing regulations and enforcing or failing to enforce them. And then finally, the courts will come in at the tail end and try and clean up the mess when things go wrong.
Well, Anna, as we go throughout this hour, I think it will be helpful for us to highlight, not in a cartoonish way. I mean, I don't want to pick villains in any way that does a disservice to sometimes the complexity of the story, but it does sort of feel that way. But I think it's useful to identify what we might think of as villains in the story, because we want to know, can there be villains like this elsewhere? Can this happen? So peel it back a little bit and tell us how you decided to write this book in the first place and how you kind of engaged that process.
Sure. Well, I'm a journalist in Detroit, and I write about a number of different things, but I've, not coincidentally by being in Detroit, got really interested in chronicling disinvested cities, like how cities are made and how they're unmade and what the policies are both in the present and in the past that created these places. And also in these cities like Detroit and also all over the country that are struggling with these really fundamental questions of what a city is supposed to do and how can it do it? Serve the public good, even when it's as you know truly beleaguered and disinvested in, when it's really at on the ropes. Like what still can we expect? What is possible? What were the reasons that created these dire circumstances in the first place? Those are the kind of stories that have always drawn me. So perhaps it was inevitable that I would end up doing reporting in Flint, which is about an hour away from Detroit. I think I came in much later than I should have, like a lot of people with this story. I didn't start reporting my first story explicitly about the water crisis until fall of 2015. After doing some of those, it was pretty clear that even a longer story wasn't sufficient to hold all the nuances of what happened here and why it happened here. And so when an opportunity to do a book came along, it was a no-brainer. I really wanted to just explore it in a deeper, more thoughtful way.
For Rochesterians who haven't been to Flint and know of Flint only really through the water crisis story, why don't you set the story that you tell your readers in the book, that this is a city with a lot of history, that it has seen population decline, mm-hmm. And in some ways similar to cities like Rochester that went from over 300,000 to just under 200,000, Flint has seen its own challenges, right?
Right, shrinking cities, right? It's a huge test of the ideals of civic ideals when this happens. So Flint, it's the birthplace of General Motors and has this really rich industrial past. It was also the site of the sit-down strike in the 1930s that was effectively the creation of the United Auto Workers, which of course transformed the world, really. At its peak in the 1960s, it had about 200,000 people. Now it has less than 100,000, so it's lost more than half of its population, as well as, you know, the majority of its economic base in GM and similar companies. So today it's about... it's much smaller. It's also much poorer, and it's a majority African-American community. It's because the city was struggling to meet so many basic needs of the residents that are there that the state a few years ago felt it was necessary to send in an emergency manager, like an appointed administrator, to have the political control of the city. That was really... important, you know, really foundational in some of the decisions that led to the water crisis. And just before I leave that, too, I think a lot of times when we talk about Flint, we talk about what it's lost, but there's a lot there, too, not least all the people that are there, but also it has, it's got beautiful, you know, parks, it's got really beautiful communities, organizations, a really gorgeous, like, cultural center. I feel like I really love Flint, and I think a lot of people do and want to see a future for it.
So there's a part of your book that I admit I'd never thought of before, and I really appreciate this framing. If you think about all of the inequalities in this country, one of the great sort of egalitarian sort of equalizers is water, that no matter how big your house is or where you live or if you're in an apartment or a house or whatever the case may be, if you turn on a tap, you ought to be able to get clean water, that your income ought not determine that. And that in that way, it kind of harkens to me to the American Postal Service, you know, that no matter where you live, how far flung, poverty or not, you ought to be able to get mail. And that is a really stark reminder that when it should be that way and then it's not that way, the question is, well, where is it not that way? And is even water being commodified in this way? So when the state steps in to say, you've got, you know, financial troubles, we're going to appoint someone, as you write in the book, the idea is, well, this is sort of an outside person who is not going to be impacted by local politics or dynamics, that they're going to be here just to help make decisions. But if it's always just based on money, what are some of the outcomes? Is that oversimplifying? What are the roots of the water crisis to you?
Well, so many. But yeah, I mean, I think there is that sense that, there has been this like strong belief that if we run our governments more like a business, they will thrive. And no doubt there are some things that would be improved, some efficiencies, some things that can be learned from the private sector that can improve the public sector. But ultimately cities aren't businesses. I mean, when they go bankrupt, you can't close them, you know, like you still have to provide drinking water to people. You still have to provide schools to children. You still have these responsibilities. You can't shut it down when you're having a budget dispute of some kind. I mean, it's a different animal. It's a different thing. And I think whether in the emergency manager system in Flint or similar experiments and elsewhere with that political philosophy, I think you keep running against that same end. I think in Flint, there was a number of different factors that directly contributed to the water crisis. And in one case, I think we're seeing the history of infrastructure inequality that was built into our cities decades ago, where some communities had better access to public services, infrastructure, housing, loans, things like that, than others, explicitly because of race and ethnicity. I think we're seeing the patterns of that continue to perpetuate with something like the water crisis. And also, I think we're seeing how the encroachment on local democracy is how dangerous that can be. I mean, a big reason this problem got as big as it did is because local residents had literally no voice. Like, they did not have the power of their own local government. And when they tried to participate democratically in other ways to alert folks to the growing problems with their water, by reaching out to folks at the state, at the EPA, to a number of people, they were not only dismissed, but actively belittled. And that went on for a year and a half, you know, before the state conceded anything. And that was remarkable, because this problem was getting worse as time went on and lives were literally on the line.
So our listeners will know that Flint had a water crisis, but let's get a little bit more specific about that. I think most people, and probably I'm sure myself included, if you think about when next time you turn on a faucet or your shower, where's the water coming from? What's the actual source? A lot of people don't know. They don't have to think about it. Again, that's sort of the one of the great sort of pleasures of living in this country. That's you know, ideally egalitarian with some of these things. But with Flint, it had changed sources. Why? What's the backstory there?
Yeah. Well, the water quality was still good. I mean, that was important. They didn't switch because there was a problem with quantity or quality with the water they had been receiving from Lake Huron for more than 50 years through the Detroit Water Department. But under the emergency manager, who had the full authority at the time, they decided that they were going to join a brand new water system and use the Flint River at their rebooted treatment plant for a couple of years until that new water system was ready to go. And the argument for this was that, you know, we will have more we'll be more empowered here. We'll have more of a say. We're not just, you know, forced to play at the whims of this major public utility. There's some legitimate gripes there. Flint was also, residents had some of the most expensive water bills in the entire nation, even before we get to the fact that it's a disproportionately poor community. While that did not, their bills, in fact, increased after the water switch rather than decreased. The language at the time of the switch was that implied that, you know, this will save the city money, and it implied that residents would in turn, you know, get some relief from these high bills, even though that didn't happen even before the water problems started. I think a lot of times the austerity, this idea that Flint switched water sources to save money, is talked about a lot. I think that's part of the story, but I think more and better questions need to be asked about the origins of the switch in the first place, because, in fact, it did not save residents money, nor the city itself, which went into what is probably a legal amount of debt, you know, beyond the legal debt limit, in order to finance that new water system that was being built outside its borders. So that's all a little wonky, but like, it's the idea is they did switch this city, its water, with great fanfare. This idea that getting drinking from the Flint River is an opportunity to get back to our roots and support ourselves. But within just a few weeks, people were noticing that it was alarming enough that they were not comfortable with it.
Should there have ever been a consideration that the Flint River, I mean, shouldn't it have been obvious? I am not an engineer. I am not a water quality expert, but I would have had big questions if you're changing your source of your water. And it turns out, as your book reveals, that there were people who were saying, hey, we're not ready for this. Yeah. We can't go online right now.
Yeah, the person who operated the water utility, this is a big factor in the court decisions right now,
yeah,
was like, I don't think this plant has the staffing or the equipment needed to treat this water source appropriately. And if this goes forward, it'll be against my, you know, like, recommendation. But indeed, it went forward.
And so within, almost immediately, it was obvious that this something was wrong here. Mm-hmm. And as you know, that showed up in many ways. That showed up in when people would take showers, drinking water, you know, kids playing in it. And I think it is very fair to ask, if this were a wealthy suburb and its water looked like this, it tasted like this, showers were like this, would it have been a year and a half before the state acknowledged something was wrong and people really took it more seriously?
Absolutely not. And everyone knows it. I mean, I think if Flint, if the water crisis had any good come from it, one thing might be how clarifying this was for a lot of folks. You could see the, this happened so dramatically and in a way that so clearly would not have happened in Ann Arbor or Grand Rapids or another community in Michigan, that it just made it utterly indisputable, the fact that people have unequal access to basic life dependent public services and to democracy too. You know, like there's a lot of reasons this water switch never would have happened in one of those wealthier and whiter communities. But even if it had, there's no way they would have been dismissed and belittled as long as they were. It just wouldn't have happened. I mean, like residents were accused of like faking the brown water, like dyeing it, like just getting attention. They thought it would get, like they were accused of like just doing it for money or what, I don't know what, but people were suspicious of them in a way that they would not have been to other residents of the same state. And even when there was other major red flags that validated what residents were saying, like this entire GM engine plant in the city that is still operating, the water within 5 months was corroding its parts so much that they had to leave the city's water and get onto a suburb's water source that still got its water from Detroit. And people very reasonably were asking, if this water isn't good enough for this machinery, why is it good enough for my children or my own body? And the state said, it is, trust us, it's fine. And it would be another year before they backed away from that. I've been thinking about this for years, and I cannot get over my shock at this.
How many people are going to be in jail over this?
I honestly don't know. Not enough. Maybe somebody else, my friend here might know better. I mean, so far, none have. This criminal investigation has been playing out for more than 3 years now. There were 15 initial indictments. Many have received plea deals. None have gone so far that they're at the trial place yet.
Before I grab Roy in Rochester on the phone, Molly McNulty, Professor, I think about Flint, and I think if Rochester had its own water crisis to that level, mm-hmm. but it happened in Pittsford, mm-hmm. I think it would be about 12 hours before something got changed.
Yeah, Anna had a very good point about access to the democratic decision-making process. I live in Brighton, which is a wealthy suburb, and take it for granted that I can pick up the phone and call Joe Morelli and say, listen, there's something really wrong, and I would be believed. And Anna pointed out in her book very clearly that folks in Flint were not believed. And there was even a quote that she had of somebody in, I think, the State Department of Environmental Quality saying, you know, this might be a problem, but I don't think Flint is the right community to intervene.
Okay. I'm going to grab our first phone call. Roy in Rochester on the phone with journalist Anna Clark. Go ahead, Roy.
Yes. I think Evan got part of it when I wondered, had anybody gone to jail? But this emergency manager's law, it seems to have, well, it was passed by a legislature, but it's been, I believe, inflicted primarily on minority cities. So is it Benton Harbor and then Flint being the most drastic case? What's happened about challenging that law?
Okay.
I'm glad you asked that. That's a really great question. Every body that has investigated the Flint water crisis, including the governor's own commission, has pointed to the nature of this emergency manager law as a contributing factor into how things happened here. The law itself remains unchanged. So it was, like a lot of states, Michigan has some system for state oversight for cities and schools that are in pretty desperate circumstances. Michigan has an unusually expansive version of this law that was broadened by the previous administration in 2011 or so. It was overturned initially in a statewide referendum on this, but then brought back 6 weeks later in a lame duck legislature with a few modifications, including appropriations, which made it immune from another voter referendum. A lot of observers believe that this law was expanded and this legislature stubbornly, you know, held on to it because they knew Detroit was headed towards bankruptcy and that an emergency manager was wanted there to help carry that out. The former mayor in Flint is somebody I talked to, and he learned that Flint would be getting its emergency manager on the very day he was reelected. And he felt that Flint was the first community under this expanded emergency manager law because it was used as a test case for Detroit to see how it would go. That was his feeling about this. It's true, it has been used in primarily African-American communities and school districts around the state, which is not to say there aren't poor white communities, especially up in the Upper Peninsula, a lot of these old mining communities and so on. But if you are a person of color in Michigan, you are much more likely to have had at some point been living under an emergency manager system than a white person.
Virginia, we're going to get to Virginia Tech coming up here. Michigan's newest governor has said that she's going to ensure that that public health comes first, that there's not going to be a way to see this kind of thing play out again, that there will be safeguards in place. Do people trust that?
I mean, I think people want to trust that. I mean, that would be great. Like, that'd be we have a new administration, and she, Gretchen Whitmer, is the new governor, a Democrat, and she campaigned, as pretty much all the candidates for governor campaign, with water as a major theme and public health a concern. And it wasn't even just Flint, too. We've been dealing with PFAS, which I imagine has been an issue around here, some water contamination stuff, and just aging infrastructure. You know, it was a priority. And if she's able to lead into this new era where people do have these, you know, can count on these safeguards, do not have to believe that their drinking water is a threat instead of something that is healthy and good, then that would be great. But it's still just a few months in, and we're kind of in the we'll see phase. Yeah.
Can I comment on
Absolutely.
That as well? I think in Flint, the tragedy, or at least part of the tragedy, is that there were legal safeguards in place. There were strong federal laws. There were strong state laws, but they weren't enough to overcome some of the structural, social, and racist barriers that were the historical legacy of the city. So while the new governor may say public health will take priority, it's not clear how she would implement that in a different way than the previous administration had done.
So how do we get to a point where we know this will not happen? I mean, now this is going to really sound sort of super nebulous and surface level, but is it literally a case where, as long as structural racism exists, that there's a risk for another one of these?
What do you think?
I would say yes.
Yeah.
Indubitably, yeah. It's just such a tough issue, and as I'm involved in public health policy and social change, so we're constantly striving to overcome some of these social tragedies in American society, and we can tinker around the edges, but until we really step forward and confront issues of segregation and poverty, public health problems are going to stay with us.
I think that I do. Like, segregation was such a was so purposeful, right? You know, every level of government private institutions, like, you know, just it was just enforced with great vigor in every possible corner. And I think even though we've had the triumph of a lot of laws that made clear that this was immoral and should not be allowed, we haven't approached inclusivity in our policies with nearly as much energy or commitment as the segregationists created segregation. And I think that's why we're still seeing some of the same pattern. We can just look around us. You know, we still live around mostly people who look like us. That's how our society is still organized. Mm-hmm. And because that system was based on geography, on location, on cities, on neighborhoods, on housing, on infrastructure, it therefore is like most evident in those same in those same settings, in the same context. I think if we're going to get at the root of the problem here, we got to make sure that that we're dealing with the most serious ways we've divided ourselves.
Sure. Anna, do you think Flint, as a water crisis, could we see a similar situation like that in Rochester, New York, or in Cleveland, Ohio, and Akron, and other places? How realistic is that concern?
I mean, you already are. I mean, Newark and Pittsburgh, they're dealing with really serious lead and water stuff right now. And for a lot of the exact same reasons. I think this is like one of the challenges writing this book is I wanted to make clear how Flint in so many ways was a singular story, but it's not an isolated case. It's as a congressman who represents Flint likes to say that, you know, Flint isn't a worst case scenario. It's a warning. And I think that's absolutely true. I mean, and we're seeing how other communities that have the same history of disinvestment are facing the consequences of that in their very water, which is all not to say that like more privileged communities are totally immune from water issues. I mean, we have lead pipes everywhere. We have old, aging, disinvested infrastructure everywhere. I mean, this is, nobody's exempt from this. Water, drinking water in particular, could be an opportunity for us to find our common good, right? You know, like to get all connected to something that all of us need. But there's, of course, no coincidence that the communities where we've concentrated vulnerability are, in fact, more vulnerable.
Yeah, there was a 2017 report that Reuters News Agency did that mapped in the United States communities that had as bad as, if not worse, lead poisoning problems with their water, and they found thousands of communities that were just as bad as Flint. Mm-hmm. So it certainly could happen anywhere.
All right. And Anna, did you grow up in Michigan?
I did. I'm in the southwest corner of the state, well away from Detroit and Flint, though.
I asked because, I mean, I grew up in a Great Lakes town outside of Cleveland, and I never remember ever hearing the word redlining in my public education growing up. Do you?
I definitely did not. And this is I grew up in St. Joseph, Michigan, which is across the river from Benton Harbor, which is the caller mentioned. It's a smaller community, majority African-American, had an emergency manager, a lot of the same stuff. And our two little towns were often contrasted with each other because of their radically different experiences with civic life. It was an early, even though I was right around a very clear example, I guess, of segregation, it was not really talked about. It was as if it was just like an unfortunate natural disaster that had happened. It's nobody's particular fault. It's just like what happened. It's all very sad, but nobody has any responsibility for anything, either historically or in the present, in changing that pattern. People get used to it. You know, we mistake what is familiar with what is normal, but it's not the same.
Let me get Andrew and Irondequoit on the phone next. Go ahead, Andrew.
Yeah, it's a terrible story. Are they educated now up in Flint and Detroit about how government should work, where you go to the councilperson, and then the councilperson has the ear of the congressperson, and the congressperson can go and scream at the mayor or the governor, excuse me, until something is done? Do they know how government works now?
Andrew, why do you think that they didn't know how government worked before?
Well, because nothing happened. I mean, if
kind of blaming the victims, I think, isn't it?
Huh?
Kind of blaming the victims there, aren't you?
I'm not blaming the victim. I'm saying if you had muddy water, Evan, you can't call up the governor, Evan, but you can call the city council person that represents your neighborhood, and that person can call the mayor, and the mayor can call the governor.
Okay,
I'm not playing the people in Flint.
No, I hear you, and I think it's a good faith question, but let me at least give you, after reading Anna's book here, my take on that, and then Anna's going to correct me and step in, and so will Molly. I think there's two issues here, Andrew. Number one, that local impact of government control and the local voice was essentially removed anyway, with the notion that state must appoint someone to control. So you can complain, whether you're in Flint or Rochester or whatever your town is, if there's not local control and local influence, you can complain all you want, but this, you know, sort of so-called unbiased outsiders there to save everything, which is really just sort of clean up the budget, they may not listen, and your local representation may not help. But beyond that, it's a question of, why is it that a community like Flint, it takes 18 months before anyone takes a complaint seriously? Because the residents were complaining up and down to anyone who would listen, whereas someone like you in Irondequoit, someone like me in Rochester, I got a feeling we would have people listening to us more quickly because of, you know, sort of the history of structural racism. That's how I took it. Does that make sense to you, or do you disagree? Are you disagreeing with what you're hearing there, Andrew?
I've never understood what you're talking about when you talk about structural racism. So,
okay.
But well, I know that a city manager came in because there's some, you know, every action has a reaction. Why was there a city manager there?
Well, let's turn to Anna Clark. It's a fair question. And Andrew, as always, thank you for the phone call. Journalist Anna Clark is the author of The Poison City, the book about Flint. Go ahead.
Sure. And it is confusing about what happened here, because the normal rules of how government worked in Michigan weren't what in play with what happened during Flint. So it is confusing. So the idea was that this city was so broke, and it was in such desperate circumstances that the state sent its own appointed administrator to the city to have the control that both the city council and the mayor would hold, and additional powers besides. So if I'm a resident in Flint and I started seeing my water was looking brown, I could go to my local council person, but that council person is not empowered at all. They have no authority. That authority is held now by the emergency manager. I could go to the emergency manager and explain. And in fact, people did. I mean, if you look back, there's plenty of evidence at public meetings, a regular lobbying visit, emails. You can see the public records of this. People were reaching out. And in fact, that's part of why two of the four emergency managers Flint had over 3.5 years are now facing charges, because the residents were not believed. They just weren't believed that their water was that bad. Residents did also, given that the state had total authority in the city, they reached out to their representatives in the state capitol. They reached out to the Department of Environmental Quality, which manages the water. Some, you know, jumped the gun a little bit and went right to the EPA within just a couple of weeks of the switch. But they were trying one way or another to reach somebody who could do something about this, who believed it was a problem. That's what took so, so long. They also had a number of, you know, public demonstrations and, you know, lobbying campaigns, and reached out to outside experts that would validate, you know, some of the things that they were saying. They were doing what they could to make themselves heard. And it's true, there is a process, but in this case in Flint, that usual process, it just didn't apply, because the local government didn't have any authority at all to do anything.
And Professor McNulty wants to add to that. I also would like you to just weigh in on Andrew's question on never really understanding structural racism.
Well, let me say what I was going to say first, and then we can talk about structural racism, which has its roots in the law. But first, I wanted to say that it wasn't just the citizens who were making a lot of noise and who weren't heard, but there were some people within government itself. In particular, I'm thinking of an employee at the EPA, the Federal Environmental Protection Agency, who wrote an email in 2015. And I'm just going to read a sentence from it. He wrote, "I understand that this is not a comfortable situation, but the state is complicit in this, and the public has a right to know what they are doing, because it is their children that are being harmed. At a minimum, the city should be warning residents about the high lead, not hiding it, telling them that there's no lead in the water." And unfortunately, this email came out in a lawsuit against the EPA, who is being sued for failing to warn the public. They yelled at the State Department of Environmental Quality loudly, but essentially his report was suppressed. And as a result, this lawsuit against the EPA came out. In terms of your second question about structural racism, I think the best way to explain it is in terms of a legal doctrine we call disparate impact. And what that means is you can have a law that applies to everybody. It doesn't intentionally target African Americans, but it has a disproportionate impact. So something like restrictive covenants in deeds to your house that say you cannot sell your house to an African American or to a Jewish person has a disproportionate effect, and the result is something that we, in other disciplines, call structural racism. So, Anna, I don't know if you want to pick up on that.
You know, part of me thinks that, you know, I guess the book is, you know, the answer to it. But like, it is a tricky concept. I think with it's about when people mean structural racism, they mean that like, any individual's intentions aren't the main point here if the consequences are the same. So nobody meant to poison anyone in Flint. Nobody purposefully wanted to see a bunch of lead poisoned kids or this 2-year outbreak of Legionnaires' disease. Nobody wanted that to happen, right? But the decisions that were made that contributed to the decision, these, you know, ostensibly these like kind of colorblind laws, like the emergency manager law, like the way this like water testing went out, the way the infrastructure is and isn't funded, some of those formulas, the way a lot of these things were applied put some communities much more at risk than other communities. And the communities that were much more at risk are just unmistakably majority like people of color. It just is. And that's what people mean when they mean structural racism. They mean that the very structure, the system, you know, like this no individual, but the way that the pattern of how the behavior of these institutions is putting more of the burden of harm on some communities than other communities.
Yeah, and Andrew, as we go to break, I'll just say again, thanks for the phone call, and think about what our guests have said earlier. Some community residents who raise concerns about coffee-colored water, kids' skin burning, irritations after showering, water that tasted nothing like water. I mean, it was obvious what was wrong, and some were even mocked. If you think people who live near Oak Hill Country Club would be mocked for the same complaints, I just don't think that history tells us it's true, and it took a long time, and now we've got a generation, possibly, of children who may have to live with this. And we all have to live with this. So I've got more of your phone calls rolling in here on the subject of Flint. The book is called The Poison City, Flint's Water and the American Urban Tragedy. The author is journalist Anna Clark. She's here in Rochester today. And again, I suspect this book is going to be kind of a reference point for what happened in Flint for decades to come. She has an event that we'll tell you about after the other side of this break, and we'll take more of your phone calls next. Coming up in our second hour, a conversation about the future of way we consume the movies. We talk a lot about the Little Theater, and yes, WXXI owns the Little, but we're proud of the work they do. We think it's different than just a big chain movie theater. And the Cinema Theater is also making an effort to preserve their place in Rochester. But is it working? How do you want to consume the movies? Do you rather do it at home? We'll talk about it next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. The event this afternoon, once again, Professor, tell us what's going on this afternoon.
This is the Political Science Department-sponsored Cutler Lecture at 4:30, featuring journalist Anna Clark, who will be talking in more depth about her book about Flint and the American urban tragedy. It's at 4:30 in Wegmans Hall on the River Campus at the University of Rochester.
Got a couple of emails from listeners wanting to know, can you drink the water in Flint today, Anna?
That's a great question. And honestly, you hear different things from different people. In some ways, we've circled right back. Personally, when I go to Flint, I do still rely on filtered water and bottled water. That's partly because the pipes, the infrastructure that delivers the water were so damaged by the water that passed through it during this crisis that they all need to be replaced. And that process won't be complete for another year or so. And so a lot of folks are kind of at the place, like, until all the pipes are replaced, I just can't trust the water yet. The state, though, the Department of Environmental Quality has, like, cited, you know, several rounds of tests that they say, like, show lead levels at what they say would say is normal levels, which doesn't mean zero, but it means similar to other communities and what Flint had before. That's one reason they stopped doing emergency bottled water distribution service to the community in Flint. But, you know, folks in Flint are also in that hard position of, like, well, this very same agency said it was safe before, and I don't know how, I just can't just automatically trust you just because you say so now.
Well, I mean, how could you blame anyone for not trusting what they're told now about the water there?
Yeah, that's one of the real costs of this, like, crisis is, like, what, I mean, Flint has, like, been beat up in many ways well before this water crisis happened. But given that drinking water is, like, something that most of us have been in this country have been able to take for granted, you know, because of the really ingenious and amazing work of those who came before us in building these drinking water systems in the first place. Like, we can take it for granted that we're very likely not going to die from cholera because of the water that we, you know, ingest. That's amazing. But folks in Flint were at that place too in so many ways, but, like, having this just, like, kind of, like, broke, like, a really key thread, you know, that they still held with civic trust. And that's, it takes a while to, like, earn that trust back, and, you know, to just be clear about that, to also be worthy of that trust, to show that you're worthy of that trust. And I think that's part of what's going to take years to rebuild.
All right. I want to get a phone call here from Francis in Rochester first. Go ahead, Francis.
Yes.
Go ahead. Yes. Are you there? Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, Dr. Edwards is my nephew, my sister's son, and he was the professor that took his crew up to Flint and started testing the water. Somebody had become so desperate, and they knew he was a professional water person, and they called him up. I'd like to read. Time magazine this year named Mr. Edwards and Mona Hannah Tisha, Flint, Michigan pediatrician whose blood lead levels reached complimented Mr. Edwards' work there in its annual list of 100 most influential people in the world. The pair gave Virginia Tech's commencement address in the spring, running into the football stadium. And I know that Mark mortgaged his house to get the money to take his crew up to Flint and do the work. And he's been treated terrible by a lot of people that didn't like being brought out like that.
Let me just jump in here, Francis, and say thank you for the call. I'm glad you brought up Virginia Tech and Mark's work. So, Anna, I know you've got a lot to say on that. Go ahead.
Well, that's a lovely call. And that's true. This Virginia Tech scientist, he grew up in the Love Canal era, you know, in New York. And I think he went to school in Buffalo. So he has, like, real roots here. And it's true. Like, after the residents had been, you know, working very hard on their own and not getting far and being having what they're doing registered, really heard, outside of that one person who was kind of acting on his own at the EPA, there was this idea that, like, okay, we're going to do we can do a citywide test to get more and better data to show what's going on with the water here. And to do that, they did need a partnership with some folks who knew how to carry that out. And that turned out to be Virginia Tech with Mark Edwards, who also has a long history with Washington, D.C.'s like lead and water stuff, that crisis that preceded Flint. And like the results from that initial test that was a partnership between the residents and the university there was really pivotal in moving this story forward and presenting in sort of showing the gaps in the numbers the state was relying on to insist that the water was safe despite all observational, all that you could see.
Are you hesitant, though, to give any sort of single voice a superhero status in the story when really it's community organizers, community voices, the hard work of the people who live there that raised this, have done the work, and have been impacted the most?
I mean, yes. I mean, this was a challenge writing the book, too, in some ways, because it's not any individual story. You know, there's a lot of people who played really important roles in the community and outside the community, and which is not to take away from really heroic efforts that a lot of people did. Yeah, thank God for them,
yes,
right? Like,
yeah.
You know, like there's, like people really put themselves out there to do the right thing. I mean, sometimes when you read Flint's story, it can be very despairing because you're like, oh my God, how did this go so wrong? How did so many people do the wrong thing when they could have done the right thing? But the inverse of that is a lot of people did do the right thing, and it made it so that this is something that you and I are talking about today. So, there's no single like hero that deserves 100% of the credit, but there's a lot of important people played a lot of important roles, including Virginia Tech, including the pediatrician, including Miguel del Toro at the EPA, and especially including like the community organizers in the city who were reaching out to those folks in the first place to get. Because they knew they needed a kind of credibility they clearly didn't have on their own.
Let me squeeze in one more phone call, and this is Anne in Rochester. Go ahead, Anne.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm Anne from Ann Arbor, Michigan, actually, and I live in Rochester, and I'm quite familiar with the Flint water crisis. And I'm wondering if the author would be willing to comment on the alleged corruption scandal that involved former Governor Schneider and some of his friends who supposedly sold the whole idea of switching water for Flint, which caused the issue. Schneider's, by the way, living in my hometown right now in a condo, and people are protesting him, and he's been thrown out of restaurants, and they have wanted signs on the light posts. And we're all aware of it when I go home. So I'm wondering if you'd be willing to comment on any of that.
All right, Anne, thank you. Go ahead, Anna.
Well, hello to a fellow Michigander. And it's true. I remember that time, especially in early 2016, when Flint was really in the global spotlight. Like, the folks in Ann Arbor did not make things easy for the governor who lived there. But yeah, I think what she's alluding to is something that I think isn't like there. It's very blurry, and it's not clear what or if there is anything going on here. But basically, the idea is kind of what I was saying before. I think that like more and better questions need to be asked about why this water switch happened in the first place. Because for example, Flint was this broke city. It's so serious that you need to bring in this outsider to have all this authority to make decisions. Flint was already at its legal debt limit because it had already, you know, tapped that out to pay for all these things that it needed to pay for, and it still wasn't enough. And the emergency manager is supposed to get rid of the redundancies and inefficiencies and all that to get the budget, you know, on par. But instead, what happened is the city did this little like kind of legal workaround borrow $80 million more dollars to finance this brand new water system that was going to give Flint, you know, that Flint would be a part of. So that's, and that's bizarre, like not just the workaround itself, which is getting some scrutiny in the lawsuits, but also the fact that Flint would borrow $80 million under emergency management, who's supposed to get rid of debt, you know, balance a budget, $80 million not to meet any of its other urgent needs like schools and public safety and all that, but to give the city something it already had, which was Lake Huron water. That's crazy. and it would have to treat it itself. That doesn't seem like that's cost efficient for the community. And that's part of what's making people go, what is actually going on here? Maybe it's all smoke and no fire. I don't want to be irresponsible here, but like there's a lot that's unproven and unknown, but it's one of the things I'm hoping this legal process will bring clarity to.
Well, I want to thank both of our guests. We've reached the end of the hour, and it just means we've barely scratched the surface, and the lessons are many in the book, The Poison City, Flint's Water and the American Urban Tragedy by Anna Clark. Thank you for being here. Thank you for the book. And we certainly appreciate the hard work and your journalism you've put in here. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you,
Molly.
And our thanks to Molly McNulty, a lecturer in public health law at the University of Rochester, helping facilitate this conversation today and this afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, short break. More Connections coming up.